today I'm going to talk to you about a technique we want to propose to achieve differential astrometry, so measure the relative position of stars, essentially, with an exquisite precision, which is microarcsecond. If the unit doesn't tell you much, I'll explain to you why that's exquisite. Now, I'm a particle physicist, so I'm not an astronomer, but probably it will become clear why four particle physicists, Ken at NYU, Mash at University of Washington, and Neil Weiner at NYU, are proposing a technique for astronomy. So there won't be much BSM, well, no BSM in my talk today. Okay, so the technique is based on intensity interferometry, which I'm going to assume that you don't know anything about. And I'm going to explain the technique and then the modification that we're proposing. Okay, so I'm going to do a Blackboard talk since this is a journal club. Right. So I'm not going to spend much time on existing imagers and optical interferometers because I just don't have enough time. I just want to say a couple of things to give you some idea of what numbers we're talking about. So how do we look at the night sky? We have optical telescopes, which are imagers. So what does an imager do? You have some parabolic dish, you have some source on the sky, the dish has some focal plane, and then you're trying to image your source on your photodetector, on your focal plane, on your CCD, on your whatever. So an imager, which are most of the telescopes, so for example, Keck in Hawaii, or for ground-based telescopes, or even space telescopes like all of you know Hubble, or JWST, or even Gaia. Right, all these telescopes just take pictures, and they're based on this principle. Now, there are all sorts of limits on how well you can do with an imager, how well you can take a picture of the night sky. There is a fundamental limit that comes from the wave nature of light, which is the diffraction limit. So take the perfect telescope, perfect parabolic mirror, perfect everything, and then you'll find that the best you can do in finding your resolution is going to be the wavelength that you're observing at over the diameter of your dish, roughly. So like the Rayleigh criterion.
Hi, sorry to interrupt you, but yeah. We don't see the blackboard on Zoom. Please, could you ask to change the view?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Can you see both blackboards?
Well, mostly the left one.
Okay. Okay. I'll try to write more here. Okay. So there is a fundamental limit on how well you can measure relative or on how well you can resolve things that are far away, and this is the fundamental limit that comes from wave optics. And essentially, what this tells you is that if you try to if you see at your focal plane. So this is my CCD camera in one spatial direction. And if I try to plot my electric field, my amplitude, or my intensity, what I'm going to see is an airy pattern for the electric field. It looks like this. And this is just telling you that diffraction tells you that this width, the full width at half maximum, is roughly lambda over d, where d is the diameter of your telescope. Of course, if I had perfect, theoretically, if I had an infinite number of photons and perfect optics, perfect everything, I could, in principle, get perfect resolution just by the signal-to-noise ratio. So in fact, my precision on how well sigma precision is going to be lambda over d times, you know, 1 over the signal-to-noise ratio, how many photons I measure. Which is just saying that if I'm sampling this function very, very well, I can very well know where this zero is. So if it is here or very, very close to it, I can resolve if I have you know, perfect localization of this function. Of course, I don't have that. And there are limits that come from instruments, for example, how good your mirrors are and how well you can measure any aberrations of your mirrors. But they also come from things that you cannot control, such as you know, thermal fluctuation of your mirrors for large telescopes, or dust, or you know, anything that essentially produces path delays of light rays more than a wavelength, actually more than a fraction of the wavelength. So this is super hard to do, which means that this is so this is at most the minimum of the SNR and how well you can localize your point spread function. And point spread function is essentially this thing and whatever modification comes from your optics and anything else. This can be on the order of 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 3, say for ground-based telescopes, which you can measure better compared to, say, space telescopes, which you can't do that well. So Gaia has about 10 to the minus 3 because like things hit your telescope, things hit your mirror, you don't know where they hit. And yeah, like debris is hitting your mirror. So this is how better you can do from your fundamental diffraction limit. And to just give you some numbers, I mean, let's just do a very simple estimate, 400 nanometers, so roughly, I don't know, green light over a 10 meter dish, right? This is going to be 10 to the minus 8 radians, 4. And then an arc second is 4 times 10 to the minus 6 radians. So this is roughly 0.01 arc seconds or 10 milli arc seconds. And then you can win by extra factors. For example, Keck has 8 meter diameter mirrors. It looks at the infrared, so not 4 here, but 10, or 2.2 for the K band or whatever you put in. So in the end, you get some resolution, which can be, you know, on the order of maybe, you know, tenths to thousands of micro arc seconds. And I want to propose a technique that goes to micro arc second here, and with light centroiding, which is what this is called, like measuring more photons, even sub micro arc second. So this is just to compare a bit with optical telescopes. Okay, so this is very roughly how imagers work. Now we have another class of telescopes. So can you see here on Zoom?
They see that one, I think, not that one.
Oh, they said left.
Oh, well, they rotated actually. Yeah, they rotated the camera, but I think it's okay. It follows you.
Okay, good. Question?
Yes. This is not accounting for seeing at all?
Yeah, so I'm not going to talk about the atmosphere because I don't have time. Okay. But if you are interested, I'll let you know. I can tell you details. But this assumes this assumes that you use some sort of adaptive optics to get rid of the atmosphere, which comes with a lot of complications. So okay, since you asked, for ground-based telescopes, because we want to propose a ground-based technique, a fundamental limit comes from the atmosphere as well, which is like putting a bad piece of glass in front of your telescope because of the fluctuations. It severely destroys your precision, and it makes it, I can tell you more details, but it makes it essentially lambda over some coherence patch of the atmosphere, which is on the order of tens of centimeters compared to the meter you have. So your resolution becomes way worse because of the atmosphere, and you need to correct for that just to reach this limit. And this is super hard to do. You need very expensive optics, essentially. So we want to propose something cheap that goes around this thing for ground-based telescopes. Good. So another class of things we use to measure relative positions of the sky are interferometers. And I'm going to refer to those as amplitude interferometers to contrast them with intensity interferometers that is the main subject of my talk. So interferometers, you can think of them very, very roughly. Of course, this is a whole science. Very, very roughly as a two-slit experiment where your slits have dimensions d, the diameter of your telescope, and the distance between the two is big, small d, poor choice of letters. So what you do with an actual interferometer is you take light incoming in both, you combine, you physically combine the light, and you measure it out with some photodetector here. Amplitude interferometers, so we have several. For example, you all know VLBI, or what? The telescope array that EHT used to measure the black hole to take a picture of the black hole of the Milky Way and of M87, yeah, right. But this operates in the radio. But we have telescopes on opposite sides of the Earth for this one. So how does this work? It works because of electronics, because there your wavelength is on the order of a millimeter. So if you have the oscillations that you need to keep track of are very slow, are millimeter compared to the optical, which is, you know, like 10 to the minus 7 meters, right? Or say like 500 nanometers. So you can keep track of these oscillations with electronics and then do the interference offline, because you know the electric field and the phase, the both amplitude and phase as a function of time. But in the optical, you cannot possibly do this because these oscillations are on the order of femtosecond. There is just no electron. There are no electronics that can do this for you. So what you have to do is physically interfere the light, which severely restricts your baseline, how far you can have your things, so you can recombine them at some central point. But you can think of it as a double slit experiment, and you know that the resolution of a double slit experiment is the wavelength over the baseline. So now it's like having a huge telescope of for the diffraction limit. It's like having a huge telescope with a diameter equal to the baseline, and of course you are only getting photons from the dishes here. And there are other issues with how, you know, if you want to do imaging with this, how you have multiple apertures, so you can essentially sample something like a whole dish. But I'm not going to talk about this. For ground-based telescopes, you can see already probably why this is actually harder than even doing imaging, because now you don't need only to have a stable image in both of the telescopes, so both need adaptive optics. You also need to keep the two telescopes in phase. Because if you think of this small d as a huge dish, you need your huge dish to be parabolic. And it needs to be parabolic within a fraction of a wavelength. So not only do you need this to be perfect, you also need the relative phase difference to be perfect. So it's extremely hard to do. You need both adaptive optics and fringe tracking, which is essentially the statement that you need the phase of these two to be the same. So expensive. OK, so I'm going to go into intensity interferometry now. And just to give you a number, you can do amplitude interferometry on the order of hundreds of meters, maybe 200 meters. I forget the number. There is gravity at VLTI. So VLTI is an optical interferometer array of telescopes. Gravity has 120 meter maximum baseline. So these are the numbers we're talking about. And what I want to do is lambda over d in the optical again, but d on the order of the Earth's radius. So I want my resolution to be super, super good. OK, how do we achieve this? We can achieve this with intensity interferometry. Questions while I'm erasing the board?
Maybe I'll ask. So like at Keck, when they do optical interferometry between dishes at Keck that are not that far apart, right? Like 100.
So it's 85 meters or something. They used to do it. Actually, now it's discontinued because of funding issues, I think.
And
no, so it's not enough to correct each dish separately. What you need is another technique which is called fringe tracking. I'm not sure actually how OKEK is doing this. I only read how Gravity is doing this, so I assume it's the same. But essentially, what you're doing with interferometers is you're measuring. So you have some. This is the plane wave that you want to have, right? But what you get from a turbulent atmosphere is some weird thing with fluctuations. So what you can measure with adaptive optics is the either let's call this difference W. Okay, what you can measure with sensors, with wave rod sensors, is either the gradient of this or the curvature of this, depending on what sensor you use and deformable mirrors, which is what adaptive optics do. They take a mirror and do slight deformations. They directly change this in your wavefront. So immediately you see that if I want to reproduce my W from this, just by measuring this, I have a phase that I don't know by solving the differential equation, right? And this is the relative phase between the two telescopes that I also need to keep track of, and this is called fringe tracking. It's keeping the interference fringes stable. So it's an extra system. Okay.
Why is it limited to only 200 meters?
Why what?
What limits you can only do this through this for the 200 meters? What gets bad if you go 200 meters over a kilometer?
Oh, you just don't. I think technicalities, like you cannot interfere the light over such huge distances. Like physically bring the two beams and recombine them. Sorry, I can't hear you very well.
Fiber optics are too lossy or something.
I'm not sure what are the technical issues. Okay. But I mean, you see that you need to bring the two beams together.
Yes.
So yeah, the further you go, I guess the harder it becomes. I'm not sure how far you can go with current technology. But the most we have right now is about 300 meters. OK.
I think it is due to build up with phase error in the fiber optics.
OK. All right, so intensity interferometry. So this is a technique that was proposed in the 1950s. Actually, it did produce some confusion at the time because people didn't believe it actually exists. By Hanbury Brown, Wanin, and Twiss. So Hanbury Brown had the idea, Twiss did the math. Right, so it was proposed in the 1950s. And just so you know, this is way before adaptive optics. Adaptive optics are 1990 plus. So this is super, super early for these things. So what is it? Let's take the following. So here I'm plotting the amplitude, say electric field, as a function of time for a chaotic source such as a mercury lamp in the lab, or a star. It's the same. And I have a photodetector one that just counts photons. Okay. So the electric field from a chaotic source is going to have fluctuations. The electric field, so this would be something like the envelope. And the electric field will have oscillations that look like this. So very fast oscillations. So this is the electric field as a function of time for a chaotic source. And here I've chosen something like the frequencies I'm superimposing are maybe less than one. So what this is literally an electric field, which is the sum over emitters, let's say all the emitters have the same amplitude, with random frequencies. I'm just summing cosines. And this is what you get from pitchfork, for example. I'm just summing emitters with different frequencies, and I'm sampling the frequencies with some from some distribution that is, say, I don't know, like 0.1 or something. So this is called quasi monochromatic light when this is smaller than one. Good. So this is what you get.
Sorry, why the same amplitude?
Wait, what? Oh no, you can have different amplitudes, but I don't care about that right now. Think of it as an atom that is emitting, and it gets random kicks. So you get Doppler broadening, and you get all these frequencies. Good. So, and let's contrast this with something like, oh, and I want to say here that the mean intensity will essentially track this envelope. Of course, intensity is the square, but like this would be something like square root of intensity or something, the envelope of this function. And let's compare this with something like a laser, which is roughly constant. So average intensity for a laser, which has some electric field. It has an electric field which has some frequency omega, okay, which is constant, which is one number. And then it will have noise on top of it if I'm measuring. So let's do the following. Let's say I have a photodetector that is counting photons, and I have some source with a finite intensity. So what is my photodetector doing? It's clicking, but there is a variance on the number of photons I'm measuring. Let's write this here. So there is a variance on the number of photons I'm measuring, which we all know, which is Poissonian. So I'm measuring photons, I get shot noise. Now, one characteristic of this is that if I calculate, so say this is the variance, so if I calculate the variance of the intensity over the intensity, so variance of number of photons over number of photons, this goes like square root of n, this over this, which is n, which goes to zero as n goes to infinity. Which is just saying that if I have an infinite number of photons, I know my intensity very well and I don't have any variance. This is just Poisson shot noise. You can already see from these two things, from the fact that the intensity here has these huge fluctuations compared to this, that these two must be different. And they are different because this thing not only has shot noise, but it also has amplitude fluctuations, which are large, an order one. So let's say I have my photodetector and it's clicking very, very fast. And I'm measuring photons here and I'm sampling at a time very, very short. So this I'm calling coherence time, which is the inverse of this band I'm looking at. And then I'm calling my photodetector resolution, how fast my photodetector clicks, sigma t. Okay, this is the time resolution. And this is the coherence time. So if my time resolution is so good that I'm measuring photons at every time, this sample the function with the same phase here. In other words, if I calculate the intensity from this electric field, this is going to have some constant term, which is like something like n squared a squared, plus a sum of all these frequencies, of all the differences of this frequency, so I different than j times t. So all I'm saying, you can see this either mathematically or from the picture, all I'm saying is that when I sample the intensity over such short time scales, I'm going to get a random thing from here, but it's going to be constant. It's going to be some number, because this is less than one. They will all add coherently in some way, in some sense.
Hey, so just to clarify for me, so the example you gave for this like mercury, should I think of the scatter and the frequencies as coming from like the Doppler shifts?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the Doppler shift gives you, I think, a Gaussian or a Lorentzian. I forget.
Gaussian.
Yeah. Gaussian.
Okay, so therefore you're saying this. Yes, you're saying that this delta omega should be a order omega times v over c.
Oh, yeah. So I'm doing something very. Yeah. So you can think of this as your wavelength. Yeah, essentially, yes. It could be order one. It doesn't have to be quasi monochromatic. I'm just doing for illustration.
Well, the v over c you're saying is large. I mean, you know, for stars, like the surface of the stars, I guess the UOC will be, I don't know, 10 to the minus 3 or something.
Yes. Right. All I want to say here is that if you're sampling at such close times, you're also going to see, you're also going to have an uncertainty, which is the uncertainty if you're measuring here, or measuring here, or measuring here, because of these macroscopic or amplitude fluctuations. Now, my variance for chaotic light is going to be squared, is going to be Poisson shot noise, just by the fact that I'm measuring photons again. But for very short time scales, it's going to scale, it's going to have another term which goes like n squared. Why n squared? Because the fluctuations are on the order of the intensity. They're order one. I have order one uncertainty in the number of photons I'm measuring. Now, if I'm measuring very far away here compared to here, there is no correlation. So in the limit where sigma t, terrible place to write, in the limit where sigma t is much, much larger than this coherence time, I'm not seeing this. Because what I would be doing is, instead of seeing a function like this in my photodetector, I am summing, say, all this thing, and I'm summing all this thing, which is my sigma t now. This blue thing, this blue band is my sigma t. So my intensity, instead of being this fastly fluctuating thing, is something like, something much slow, much more slowly varying. So now my macroscopic fluctuations are much, much smaller. I'm smoothing out my intensity. So I'm getting a suppression, which is the coherence time over whatever my resolution is. And in the limit that my sigma t is infinite compared to tc, I'm seeing a constant intensity. Like if you measure once, you're going to get one number, and that's your intensity. So in that limit, there is no such fluctuation. The difference, the qualitative difference from this.
The power spectrum of these fluctuations, so like, I guess the power spectrum you said will be related to this, like the distribution of the frequency.
A Planck spectrum for a star, like a blackbody spectrum for a star. A thermal light, right? And the width there is basically the temperature, so it's order one. Okay?
I need to think more through it, okay.
So the qualitative difference is that this sigma of intensity for chaotic light over intensity in the limit that n goes to infinity doesn't go to zero, but it goes to tc over sigma t, which is telling you that you have macroscopic fluctuations of the intensity itself. And this is the thing where that intensity interferometry relies on, which is the fact that if I have two photodetectors and they're sampling very close to each other, they're going to see some correlated increase, some correlated fluctuation, because both sample the function when it's very big, or both sample the function when it's, small. Questions? Okay.
So for starlight, you need to know this difference to some femtosecond precision?
Yeah, so I'll go into this. Yeah. Right, for starlight, TC, if it's on the order of the wavelength that you're looking at, which is optical, it's on the order of a femtosecond, which is super fast, as I told you before, for the photodetectors we have. The best you can do, so sigma t, in the 1950s, was a nanosecond, in the 1950s, where they used PMTs, these photo multiplier tubes. And today, with current technology, you can do 10 picosecond and smaller than 10 picosecond using SNSPDs, which are superconducting nanowire single photon detector technologies, or SPADs, which are a more mature technology. And these do, well, this actually might be a bit worse, maybe 50. But these are diodes. So you take a diode, you put a current, what's called, I forget the name, a reverse current, and then a single photon produces an avalanche, and you can measure, so you can measure single photons with this, with diodes, which are much, much better than PMTs nowadays. And this is what made particle physicists essentially think about techniques in astronomy, because astronomers don't usually think about super fast photo detection, whereas we do, because we need single photon detection for dark matter searches. Good. So, okay. So let me show you how you can. What is the observable? Yeah.
Can you say a little more about how you identify the coherence time with the wavelength as opposed to like the envelope fluctuations you're talking about as
yeah.
opposed to the smaller one?
So, I mean, this essentially comes from your spectrum. So whenever you're trying to do an intensity, okay. So, right, if I have an electric field, which is the sum of emitters, it's a sum of emitters with some amplitude. Let's take it outside. Then each emitter will have a phase, which will be its own phase. Okay. So if I try to calculate t squared, I'm going to get ij ai, aj omega I minus omega j plus phi I minus phi j. Okay. If I'm averaging, which I am, over large time scales, then this term will only be non-zero for the same emitter. So this will be delta ij in this sum. So what I'm getting is this. It's this, ai. In the continuum limit, the amplitude of each emitter has to do with its spectrum. So in the continuous limit, this looks like delta k times the power spectrum. The power spectrum. So this, for thermal light, this is the Planck function. And from this, you can see does this answer the question, or do you want the extra step?
She's just asking, I think, why is delta omega or omega? Is that what you mean, Jesse?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, and for, I guess, like starlight, yeah. I mean,
yeah. It's just saying how for how many frequencies are these amplitudes roughly the same, and where do they go to zero? And it's order one frequencies where you get, because it's an expansion, right? So it's order one t that these amplitudes are the same. So you have all these frequencies adding together. And so when you have this cosine term, this is what sets your bit. Your bit is set by delta omega. Does that?
So Marius, you can also play with delta omega by putting filters, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll go into that, hopefully. Good. So let's see what's the observable.
So perhaps you want delta omega to be smaller than omega after all, right? Like maybe not dramatically smaller, but kind of smaller, right?
Right. So in general, you want, because you are definitely not going to see the fluctuation on the order of femtosecond. You definitely need your coherence time. So your coherence time is going to be set by whatever frequencies you see, which can either be natural, the natural band of the light if you put no filter. But if you put the filter, you can cut out on some frequencies. So your coherence time would be whatever your wave band is. Of course, if you use a super narrow filter, then you cannot see faint sources because you're throwing away all the photons. So there is a compromise between how narrowband your filter is and how bright is your source. so that you can see this correlation. And
filter, could you just like disperse the light?
Yes. I will talk about this. Yeah, and in general, for what what Henry Brown and Twiss did, still the filter they used was such that there is a suppression. The coherence time from the filter was still shorter than the time resolution of a nanosecond. Good. So the observable now is I want to look for spatial structure, which is differential astrometry. This is spatial. This is how far two things are. So say I have star A and star B, telescope 1, telescope 2, and I'm recording light from both stars in both telescopes. So my electric field, let's write it here, my electric field is going to be some amplitude, e to the I omega t minus I k r, distance from, you know, say this is array 1. So from star C to telescope J, it's going to be C and J, plus I, some phase of the emitter that I'm measuring at the phase of the emitter that I'm measuring at the retarded time in my telescope, C, J. This is saying nothing. This is just saying that I have an emitter that is fluctuating randomly, which is this phase, and then the usual propagation phase. So this is emitter A, and then I have the same for emitter B. Omega equals to K, plus I phi B. This is in the exponent. Okay? So I have two emitters that are fluctuating randomly, and I'm detecting them with two photodetectors.
So what is CJ?
C is from star C, and J is to telescope J. So I'm just saying that, you know, telescope 1 will have the electric field from star A in telescope 1 will have RA1. Just notation. I'm just denoting all things together. Is this confusing?
Okay, yeah. But it's the phi sub, you've got a phi sub A and a phi sub B. Is that just the phi sub C? A and B exactly.
Yeah, sorry, you're right. So this is E just a telescope J, you're right. Yeah, and it's the sum of the two emitters. And this is, this is A.
Or you're summing over C.
Okay. Yeah, I'm summing over C. I wanted to write this and then I decided to do the other thing and... Okay. Yeah, sorry. But this is just electric field from one emitter, electric field from the other emitter, and I'm measuring both at both telescopes. So now, if I try to do what I'm interested in is this quantity, intensity in telescope 1, intensity in telescope 2. So if I just follow my nose, what I'm going to see if I do this calculation is the following. So I'm going to get some term, right? This is electric field in telescope 1, electric field in telescope 1 star, telescope 2, telescope 2 star. So two terms here, A and B, two here, two here, two here. I'm going to get some term that has all A's, so A from telescope 1 and A from telescope 2.
Is it all at the same time?
For now, yeah. I'm doing the simplest thing right now. You can object because it will be wrong in the end, but I'll explain why it's wrong. I'm going to put extra complications as I go on, okay? So right now I have the same time. And I have, so I'll have a term that has all A's. I'll have a term that has all B's. This doesn't tell me anything. It's just intensity in from star A, intensity from star B. There's no correlation there. It's the one in my correlation function. But I'm going to have a term that looks like A from here, another A from here, a B from here, and a B from here, okay? And to write this better, this is just a squared, just for space, b squared. Okay? And why did I choose them? Did I choose them this way? I chose them this way because, okay, you'll see. So I'm going to have some exponential that looks like k. All these phases RA1 minus RA2 plus B2 minus RB1. This is telling you nothing right now, but it will tell you in a minute. But the important thing is, is that I have all these phases. So RA1, RA2, and then B star RB2 minus phi at t minus RB1. So think of the limit where RA1 is equal to RA2 and RB2 is equal to RB1. What would that be? That would be telescope 1, telescope 2, and something exactly in the middle. Both star A and star B are in the middle, and these path lengths are the same. This is what would mean for this to be the same and for the other two to be the same. In that case, when I'm sampling this over, when I'm calculating this correlation, but I'm averaging over some long time because my photo detector is not perfect, what this is telling you is that in that case, this is zero, this is zero, so I get full correlation. I get this full term, okay? Because these phases just cancel. They fluctuate randomly, but they cancel. If my path lengths are different, so if my telescope one was here, and still these two were on top of each other, these phases by themselves wouldn't cancel, neither for this one nor for that one. So when I do an average over long times, which is over the sigma t, the resolution of my photodetector, because these fluctuate randomly, they fluctuate on the time scale of the coherence of light, which is much smaller than my time resolution, this phase averages out. It's just a cosine over a long time. So there is no correlation. Does that make sense? OK. So what does this give me? OK, I'm running out of time, so. There is some real part and stuff. So what I'm getting in the end is my correlation function normalized, I1, I2, over the average values, minus 1, because I don't care about the constant term, the uncorrelated part, is going to be some number. I'll tell you what this number is. Let's take the case where these two are the same as these two. So it's going to be some cosine of k omega, sorry, k d times theta relative. I didn't define these quantities, sorry. This is the baseline d. And if this is some distance on the sky, the relative angle of the two is this angle minus this angle. So this is small. You can think of this as 10 to the minus 6 radians for an arc second, or even smaller. But this is this theta relative there is the angle that these two stars have subtend on the sky. And this is my baseline, which I want to do kilometers. So this is what I'm going to get if these path lengths are the same. If they are not the same, I'm not going to get any correlation. Because as I told you, these phases will average out. And what this is saying is that I'm not sampling this function at the right times. I'm sampling here and I'm sampling there because I have some time delay. First photodetector sees this, the other one sees this, but translated in time. Okay? So I need to fix this. How do I fix this? With a very simple thing. I just add the time delay in the short one. So instead of measuring at the same time, I'm just saying, oh, let me measure at a slightly at a time slightly ahead, right? So that I measure the photon. So that I'm measuring essentially the same photon as this telescope 2 measures here. So if I'm doing this, what I'm doing is instead of having this phase, is telescope 2 gets a tau, telescope 2 gets a tau, and I can choose my tau to be RA1 minus RA2. And because I chose them to be on top of each other, this is also going to be RB1 minus RB2. So if I can choose such a time delay, I'm done. I see the correlation. But as I'm changing this time delay, I'm not going to see the correlation. Okay, and that would be temporal coherence. This is what it's called temporal coherence. It has to do with time. I'm not interested in this, so let's assume that I'm fixing this and it's perfect and it works. And then I'm averaging. Of course, I cannot know this perfectly, so I have to average, which means that my correlation function is going to be Tc over resolution of my detector. This just from the fact that I'm not measuring the full correlation. I'm not measuring the individual oscillations. Okay?
Are you assuming that the phases, the phase functions phi A and phi B are the same for both sources? They are not,
no.
Right? But I don't understand, how can there be any correlation at all if those two phase functions are different? They can be totally different. You don't know them.
Yeah.
Right? So what's the physics? So what's the correlation? What's the actual correlation?
Because the actual correlation is that, you could ask the same question here because I did nothing different. Here, I just had multiple emitters. Here, I put star A and star B on top of each other. So it's just like putting two emitters. It's exactly the same as this. The correlation appears because I have such a chaotic function and I'm sampling at the same time. It's exactly the same thing. If I'm putting the stars on top of each other, it's like having just one thing that is emitting, as I told you before. Because before, I also said that I have multiple emitters, multiple omega j's. OK? It's the same thing.
So this is like the same, though, as like normal interferometry, where you just add some delay to like one of the detectors. And then by varying the delay, then you are changing which part of the sky you're looking at, right?
Right. So this is just like regular interferometry. The advantage, so in fact, there is a formal way to see this, and the formal way is that this regular interferometry measures this visibility function, which is some correlation of electric fields, and measures the complex thing because it measures both amplitude and phase. And you can prove that this second order correlation is one, which is this one, sorry. C, no, not C, this. This is one plus the modulus of this function, maybe squared. Modulus of this visibility function of amplitude interferometry. Maybe, I don't remember if it's squared or not. Okay, I think it's squared. Okay, you can prove that essentially you have the same, almost the same observable. Not quite the same because you lose phase information, but they are related. And they are related because of what I'm going to say just now, which is that if I buy that I have this function for the relative distance of the two stars, right? If this is my function, this is just saying, like, this is just the same as regular interferometry. I have a resolution, which is 1 over d times lambda over d, the baseline d. But now I don't need to physically interfere the light because I'm counting photons. I have super fast photodetectors, and I can measure this quantity without having to do what amplitude interferometry does. Okay? The reason why it's a cosine there is because this is going to fluctuate. As I'm changing the baseline, as I'm making the baseline bigger and bigger, this path length at some point will be, say, 2 pi times the other one. The phase difference will be 2 pi times the other one, and this is when the cosine comes back to itself, which is why this is a cosine there. This is not correct, though, because you have some finite waveband here. And the problem is that you lose correlation because you have a finite waveband, which is what I was telling you all this time, that if you take this average value here and these are far away from each other, you get zero. So there is something here that is an exponential that goes like sigma t squared, and then you have the time delay. Okay, so I need to choose my time delay to be this so that I have my correlation. Okay, now there is another issue with this, which is not just temporal, but it's also spatial. So let's say, what do I want to do? I want to choose a time delay which makes these phases the same, and a time delay that makes these phases the same. This is what I want to do here. I want to cancel both the phi a's and both the phi b's, which is saying that I want to make both the paths from star a the same and the paths from star b the same. But if a and b are very far from each other, I just can't do that, because I have one quantity I want to choose, which is tau, and I have two things I want to fix, two relative path lengths, relative path length telescope 1 and relative path length telescope 2. So I cannot do that. And this gives me, again, a suppression, because it's telling me that whenever I'm trying to cancel these phases, I cannot do it efficiently. I can cancel only one of those if the sources are far away. So what you find, if you do the calculation, is that you get a suppression which has the inverse of the wave band, delta lambda squared, times kd times theta rho squared, all this in the exponent. So I'm getting a suppression because of the finite wave band. Does that make sense?
The dimensions don't make sense, but I mean, I can.
The dimensions what?
A lambda over lambda. Is there like a k there? Like in the exponent.
Sorry, you're right. Yes. Yeah, it's not set by the central frequency. It's set by the wave band. So, yeah. Okay. And here you can see what is one of the main problems with trying to make this over very, very short, trying to do micro arc second resolution. And the reason is my resolution in this theta relative is going to be lambda over d that I told you. But my field of view, which is how far I can have these sources, is going to be delta lambda over d. I can always choose a super narrow band filter and make this very large, right? So I can explore higher and higher order fringes of this cosine. And it will look like this. Oh, yeah, it will look like this. So if I have a super narrow band filter, this is the correlation function I was telling you about. This is the baseline times the relative separation on the sky. And then sure, I can have many of these, but at some point I'm going to be cut off. And I cannot have a super narrow band filter because I'm not going to get enough photons. I'm cutting out all the flux if I have a very narrow band filter. So if I try to do micro arc second, this can be what? Maybe milli arc second. There are no sources. If there are, they are extremely rare sources that are milli arc second away on the sky. So this is not what I want to do. What I want to do is keep this, but make this an arc second. This is what would be great, because sources over arc seconds are plenty. Okay? Now, okay, I'm out of time. Which is bad. What I just want to say is that if you, just a number, that using this technique, this is all Hanbury, Brown, and Twiss in the 1950s, they measured stellar radii with 30 micro arc second precision. What this is the image of the black hole. This is 50 micro arc seconds. So in the 1950s, with super rudimentary technology, they could do this precision on the sky. Of course, for very bright sources. I mean, this is completely different. This is radio. This is a thousand different things. But I'm saying that the precision is incredible, okay? Even in the 1950s. So our idea is extremely simple.
I didn't quite get it. So what the atmosphere does with all that? And also, when you consider the two stars, you assume that they're monochromatic in your kind of toy model, right? But they will be themselves, each of them will be a collection of frequencies. So how this is dealt with?
Yeah, this is this delta lambda that I'm talking about here. This is not the correct calculation. You have to sum, I mean, There's no,
right.
This doesn't give you that. The proper calculation gives you this. I just can't write down the whole calculation for you. It's complicated.
Okay, okay. Yeah, but what about the atmosphere? Yeah, what does it do with all this actually?
The atmosphere?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It doesn't matter for us. I just want to say what is our technique because I have 2 minutes left. But you can ask me afterwards.
Why does it matter for that, for what you described already?
For what I described already, okay. So the atmosphere, this is going to take a long time. Can I tell you, like, after I'm done?
Also, can we extend this to like next week, maybe, or?
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind. I mean, it's, it takes time to explain the effect.
Yeah, but I think it's interesting.
I'm happy to do next week, too. Okay, I'm happy to do next week. So I have 1 minute left. I'll just tell you the idea. I'll tell you about the atmosphere next time because it's going to take more than 1 minute.
Okay.
To explain. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So good. So our idea is the following simple thing. If you follow this up to here, which I hope you do, I have these two numbers that I want to fix. All I need to do is, and I have this time delay, well, let me just put another parameter and fix this parameter to fix, you know, choose t and this cell that I'm putting in to fix these two numbers. Extremely simple. How do I do this physically? What I need to do physically is after I correct for t and after I correct for t, these two paths will be the same for star A. These two paths will be almost the same for star B, but one of those, this, will be too short. This is what this is saying, the fact that I cannot choose these phases to be the same. So let me put a set of semi-transparent plates in front of my telescope and have my B do one reflection. And this is what I mean by 2L. L is the separation of these plates.
But not for A.
And what do I get? Because I get everything. So I'm just going to finish here. So what I'm getting is this. Semi-transparent plates, photo detector, telescope 2. If I had no plates, I would get this. Star A, star B. Of course, I get it here too. I have this transmitted twice and the other one transmitted twice. But I get all higher order terms. I get star A going in, and star B doing one reflection, right? And I get all higher order terms. So A doing two, B going through, both going two, all higher order terms. But if I choose my 2L, if I tune this appropriately, all these other things are going to be exponentially suppressed. Because what I'm doing is changing this path length but choosing only one of those. So what I'm doing is I'm splitting my fringe. I have my final C will be one for, say some suppression which comes from the photons that are reflected and transmitted. So it will be C times this plus C times a different path length, right? This theta relative is the path length. So the second C will be this. The third, this one, for example, will have the wrong sign. It will be plus 2L. This will be plus 4L, or whatever this is. Actually, this is they both cancel, so it's like this, but with a smaller amplitude because of reflection. And all higher order terms. So if now I choose my 2L to be close to this, d times theta relative, this cosine will also change. We'll also have a 2L here. But now, as I'm changing L slightly, I have a reference angle, which is 12. So now my correlation looks like this. So now instead of the cosine that started from 0, I have some reference angle, which I start from, which is the 2L that I'm choosing. But my precision remains 1 over KD. I don't have now my field of view to be, well, my field of view is sort of, you know, the same, 1 over KD around that reference angle. But I can have such a big reference angle. And the fringes start from this reference angle here. This is the idea.
And then the idea is, since you still have a very small field of view, but in a tunable spot on the sky.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. So I can have very, very, very good precision on things that are separated by a big angle, which is what I want to do.
So what precision do you achieve?
So the precision is the same. So depends on your baseline. If you can do 1,000 kilometers, this is sub microarcsecond. Just by diffraction, right? I'm not even talking about light centroiding yet. Just the diffraction limit is sub microarcsecond. I mean, there are all sorts of things that I can tell you, but I'll leave them for next week.
And just the reason you can do 1,000 kilometers, you're saying, is because you don't have to directly interfere the light from the two telescopes now.
Exactly. I just need 2 very fast photodetectors in both sites, and I'm done.
The data rate for that is pretty intense, right?
Good. So the data rate is right. The sources are sort of faint. I think by a back of the envelope calculation, you get something like 0.1 terabytes per night.
Well, I was getting like a terabyte per second. Maybe you're that wrong.
What?
I got something a lot higher. A terabyte a night is fine.
Yeah. It's like if you just say photon counts in a sparse array or something. Its photon count is like 1 bit, so roughly. And this gives you about 1 terabyte. Assuming everything that I haven't told you, how you record this and how many channels you have and how it works. I'm going to leave the details for next time.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Mark.